What am I thinking about? Maybe where Jackie Juarez ended up, whether she decided to convert, or whether she ended up in one of the camps along with the rest of the LGBTQIA crowd. My money's on the camp. Reverend Carl dreamt up the idea, which was a hit with the pure majority, until they balked at the idea of putting gay men and lesbians in cells with each other. It would be counterproductive, they argued. Think what they'd get up to. So Reverend Carl modified his plan and decided to pair one woman and one man in each cell.
They'll get the idea soon enough, he said.
Of course, the camps are only a temporary thing.
Until we get on track, in Reverend Carl's words.
The camps aren't camps at all. They're prisons. Or they were prisons before the new executive orders on crime were signed. There isn't much need for prisons anymore, which isn't to say there's no crime. There is, but the criminals don't need to be put anywhere. Not for long. I answer Patrick after cleaning up the red mess of tomato on the tile. Nothing. Pulse. Ding. You're out, kiddo. The clock's hands have decided to move at a snail's pace since our telephone rang. He gives me a kiss on the cheek.
Another few minutes, and everything's going to be back to normal around here.
I nod. Sure it is. Until I find a cure. 22. Dinner, despite my best efforts at my mother's sauce, is a disaster. Sonia isn't here, but in her room. I stayed with her for an hour after Thomas of the dark suit and dark attitude came and removed the counters. He did have a time with Sonia's because she wouldn't stop wriggling away. She even bit his hand on the second try. No blood, but Thomas yelped like a surprised puppy and cursed under his breath on the way to his car.
It's all right, baby. You can talk now, I said, soothing her when we were alone in her room.
She said one word.
No.
You don't have to go to school anymore, I said. We'll have our own classes here at home. We'll read stories, and when I'm at work, you can watch cartoons over at Mrs. King's house. I hated the idea of Sonia spending even a minute in the company of Evan and Olivia King, but I hated it less than sending her back to PGS. Everything, lately, seems to be a choice between degrees of hate. At the mention of school, she started bawling again.
You don't really like it there, do you? I said.
She nodded.
Use your words, Sonia.
She sat up and pressed her lips together. At first, I thought she was playing the tough girl, as tough as a 6-year-old can be when she's swathed in pink sheets and surrounded by stuffed bunnies and unicorns. She was only getting ready.
I was going to win tomorrow, she said, and her mouth clamped shut again.
I could almost hear the click of a steel key turning in its lock while she looked longingly at her naked wrist. Finally, Leo poked his head in the doorway.
Sauce is bubbling, Mom, a lot.
How about turning off the gas? I said, wondering how I was going to work, teach Sonia, and deal with a household of incompetent males over the next several months. Then, turning back to Sonia, I said,
We'll work on a different kind of prize tomorrow, okay? Let's go eat.
She only shook her head and grabbed hold of Floppy the bunny. At the table, it's Stephen who puts words to my worries.
How are you going to teach Sonia and work and take care of the house, Mom?
He says around a mouthful of pasta.
We still don't have any milk.
In my mind, I take hold of him by the collar and shake him until he's dizzy. In reality, I say,
You could ride your bike over to Rodman's and buy it yourself. Or you could walk to the 7-Eleven. Not my job, Mom.
Sam and Leo bury their noses in bowls of pasta. Patrick goes red.
Stephen, one more word like that and you can leave the table.
You need to get with the program, Dad,
Stephen says. He takes another bite, a shovelful, really, and leans forward on his elbows. One finger pokes the air.
See, this is why we need the new rules, so everything can run like it's supposed to.
He doesn't seem to notice that I'm staring at him as if he's from outer space.
Take me and Julia.
Julia and me, I say.
Whatevs.
Me and Julia have it planned out. When we get married and have kids, she'll take care of that house stuff while I'm at work. She loves it. I'll make the decisions and Julia will go along. Easy peasy.
I put my fork down and it clangs against the rim of the plate. You're too young to get married. Patrick, talk to him.
What your mother said,
Patrick says. Way too young.
We've talked about it.
You've talked about it, I say, still not eating. How exactly do you do that on Julia's 100 words a day? I'm curious.
Stephen sits back, done with his second bowl.
I haven't talked about it with Julia, he drawls. I've talked about it with Evan.
My blood is beginning to boil. Does Julia get a say? There's no response from my son, only a bewildered look, as if I've suddenly begun speaking in tongues. We stare at each other across the table like strangers until Patrick interrupts.
Let it go, Jean. No sense in fighting about it. He's too young anyway.
Then he looks over at Stephen.
Way too young.
Wrong again, Dad. A guy from the Department of Health and Welfare came to our school today. Major assembly. He talked about how next year they're rolling out a new program. Get this. $10,000, full college tuition, and a guaranteed government job for anyone who's married by 18. Boys, of course. And another $10,000 for each kid you have. Pretty sweet, huh?
Sweet as snake venom, I think.
You're not getting married at 18, kiddo.
A smile works its way onto Stephen's face, only a touch of a smile that isn't joined by his eyes. It's really not a smile at all.
You don't have anything to do with it, Mom. It's Dad's decision.
Maybe this is how it happened in Germany with the Nazis, in Bosnia with the Serbs, in Rwanda with the Hutus. I've often wondered about that, about how kids can turn into monsters, how they learn that killing is right and oppression is just. How in one single generation, the world can change on its axis into a place that's unrecognizable.
Easily, I think, and push out my chair. I'm going to call my parents, I say.
I tried yesterday and got no answer. This morning, no answer. Before dinner, no answer. It will be late over there, nearly midnight, but I want to talk to my mother. It's been way too long.
23. On Thursday morning, I put on a suit for the first time in more than a year. I had to climb up into the attic for it, forage through the boxes I'd stuffed with my better clothing in the days after Sonia and I were fitted with our counters. I hardly remember what I was doing, only that I had to keep my hands busy at trivial tasks, otherwise they would have found their way into walls or windows. The outfit I choose is beige linen for the heat. There's barely time to press out a year's worth of wrinkles and get my act together before the doorbell rings. Patrick lets the man in, and I recognize him instantly. It's Morgan LeBron, from my old department, the all-too-young and completely incapable little shit who took over Lynn's position. No wonder the president agreed so quickly to my conditions. Morgan is an idiot who doesn't know he's an idiot. The worst kind. He steps in and holds out a manicured hand.
Dr. McClellan, I'm so happy to have you on my team. So happy.
Of course you are. And it's his team, not the team, not our team. I take his hand. I've always had a firm grip for a woman, and shaking hands with Morgan is a bit like shaking with a newborn kitten. I'm happy too, I say. Pussy.
So, he says, shall we get to business? I've got some paperwork for you to sign, and we'll need to set up a direct deposit to your husband's account. Whew, hot in here.
The AC's on the fritz, I say. We can go into the back room. There's a window unit in there. No sense in asking why my paychecks will go to Patrick's account. All my money has been sitting there since last year. Words, passports, money. Even criminals get 2 out of 3. At least, they used to. I lead him through the house, stopping at the kitchen to refill Patrick's and my coffee and pour Morgan one of his own. He takes it with 3 spoons of sugar and a fat inch of milk, which I remembered to run out for last night after the disaster of a dinner with Stephen and Sonia's meltdown.
She seemed to brighten a little when Olivia King came to pick her up, possibly because I told her Mrs. King had a cartoon cable channel and would bake some cookies today. Possibly the smile on my daughter's face had to do with the lavender counter on our neighbor's wrist. Something normal. The first set of papers Morgan takes out of his briefcase is a contract, a non-compete agreement, as if I had any other job prospects, a non-disclosure agreement, and a work-for-hire acknowledgement. This last is a 5-page-long reminder in legalese that all of the work I create belongs not to me, but to the government. I take the pen Morgan offers and sign everything without reading, wondering why they even need a signature, since they'll do what they want in any case. Patrick signs the direct deposit forms and hands them over. I do, however, note the compensation terms. $5,000 a week and a bonus of $100,000 if I complete the cure by August 31st. The bonus is reduced by 10% for every month after this date, so there's incentive to work fast in a way, but the sooner I'm done, the sooner the metal counters go back on Sonia's and my wrists. I know they will eventually. It's only a matter of time. Perfect, Morgan says, removing a machine from his briefcase. The slim black object is like an iPhone, only larger. He sets it on the coffee table between us. Security check. He presses a button, swipes, and enters my name. Thumb is 1, index finger 2, and so on. Just follow the instructions and hold your finger to the screen until you hear a beep. Naturally, they'd want a fingerprint check. I do as I'm told, and after the machine scans my left pinky, Morgan picks it back up and waits.
This will only take a few seconds. If you're cleared, we can unlock your files and head over to my lab.
Again with the my. I wonder how much of my work, my and Lynn's work, that is, will wind up with Morgan's signature on it.
Okie dokie, Morgan says when the machine pings. You're clear.
He turns to Patrick, who has been holding a set of keys in his hand throughout the signing and fingerprinting party.
Sir?
Patrick leaves, and doors start to open. First, his study. Then the metal file cabinet next to the window. Then the closet where I suppose my laptop and files have been living for the past year. While he's gone, Morgan shuffles through another set of papers.
Here's the team,
he says, handing me a copy. At least he hasn't said my again. If he did, I might have to slap him. The team leader, of course, is Morgan LeBron himself. There's a short bio after his name, including a reference to his latest position. Chair, Department of Linguistics, Georgetown University. Underneath, the rest of us are in alphabetical order. First, Lynn Kwan and her credentials, which include the word former. Then me, also former. Each instance of that word is a poke in the eye. But I'm not ready for the gut punch that follows. The third surname on the list is Rossi. First name, Lorenzo. 24. It's been so long since I've used my laptop, I'm worried it might not power up, that a year of non-use will have sent it into the same dormant silence I fell into. But it's obedient, like an old friend waiting for a phone call, or a pet sitting patiently at the door until its owner comes home. I trace a finger over its smooth keys, wipe a smudge from the screen, and collect myself. A year is a long time. Hell, when the Fios in our house went down for 2 hours, it seemed like the end of the world. 8,760 hours is a lifetime longer than 2, which is why I need a moment before I walk out of this house, start the Honda, and follow Morgan to the lab where I'll be spending 3 days a week from now until I finish fixing the president's brother. Also, I need a moment to sift through my files, the ones I copied and kept at home so I didn't have to lug the same shit back and forth to my campus office. There are reports I don't want Morgan to see, not until I can speak to Lynn. The bottom folder is the one I want, the folder with the red X on its front flap. Patrick has already gone to work, and Morgan is out in his Mercedes making phone calls, likely gloating to Reverend Carl about what a fantastic team he's put together,
which leaves me here in the paneled room with its humming window air conditioning unit and, I don't know, about 5 million pounds of books. They don't weigh that much, but the teetering piles of texts and journals are like academic maces littering the rec room. We haven't used the sleeper sofa in a year and a half, not since the last houseguest came to visit. No one really visits anymore. There's no point. We tried it once, a dinner party for some old friends I'd met when Stephen was still in diapers, but after an hour of the men talking and the women staring into their plates of salmon, everyone decided to go home. I pry up the corduroy-covered cushion next to me and slip my red X folder in among a few cracker crumbs, a stray piece of popcorn, and some spare change. This it, encased in a dull manila folder rubbed shiny by my own hands, is the work that will, when I'm ready, reverse Wernicke's aphasia. I've thought about finding a more permanent hiding place for it, but given the year's worth of crap I find beneath the sofa cushions, I don't see the need. No one, not even Patrick, knows we had passed the brink from close to finished, although I believe Lynn and Lorenzo suspected. The day before Thomas and his taser-carrying men came for me the first time, I had been winding down a lecture on linguistic processing in the posterior left hemisphere, the area of the brain where temporal and parietal lobes meet. Wernicke's area, and the language loss that accompanies damage to this complex cluster of gray matter, was the reason most of my students signed on for this seminar. And on that day, the room was packed with colleagues of colleagues, the dean, and a few out-of-town researchers intrigued by our group's latest breakthrough. Lynn and Lorenzo sat in the back row as I talked. They must have seen the gleam in my eyes when I moved through the slides of brain imagery on the projector, zooming closer to the target area. The serum we would use wasn't mine. Repairs would happen naturally, with the aid of an interleukin-1 receptor antagonist, a drug already widely in use to counter the effects of rheumatoid arthritis, and infant stem cells, which would increase the plasticity of the subject's brain, encouraging rapid repair and rebuilding. One of my contributions, our contributions, involved pinpointing the exact locus of application without affecting the surrounding areas of cortical tissue and causing further damage. We had another ace up our sleeves. One Wednesday morning last spring, when the cherry blossoms had exploded into photogenic candy and Washington had begun to flood with its annual onslaught of tourists, Lorenzo pulled me into his office. Of course, he kissed me. I can still taste the bitter espresso on his lips. Strange how a kiss can turn bitter into sweet. He kissed deep and hard, as lovers do when kisses are stolen or come with a price, but then he broke away and smiled. "I'm not done yet," I said. His eyes swept up and down, from the widow's peak on my forehead all the way to my black pumps, the ones I had started wearing to work instead of my more comfy loafers.
"Neither am I," he said. "But first, I've got a surprise for you."
I did like Lorenzo's surprises. I still do. While I floated down from my kissing high, he pushed files and journal articles aside on the desk until he landed on whatever he was looking for.
"Here, check the numbers for me."
The stats looked good. Fine p-values showed significance. Solid chi-squares and experimental design told me he knew his statistics shit. I took in the data as if they were water and manna sent to a deserted Robinson Crusoe. "You're sure?" I said, checking over the data.
"Positive."
He stood behind me, his arms circled around my waist, creeping up like 5-legged spiders to my breasts.
"Of a few things."
We hadn't done it on campus, not the big it, not the holy grail of physical intimacy. Only kissed and run our hands over each other's bodies behind the locked door of Lorenzo's office. Or mine. Once, he followed me into the faculty washroom and, I'm ashamed to say it, made me orgasm with nothing but a finger. After 17 years of marriage and 4 kids, it didn't take long. He must have felt the heat growing in me, because he let go, let me read through the reports. "Holy shit," I said. You isolated the protein?
We had been searching for that one last piece, the biochemical substance we knew was present in some people and absent in others. Lorenzo had run the numbers on more than 2,000 subjects, searching for an indicator that might predict lexical proficiency. He called it the Kissinger Project, and his background in both biochem and semantics made him exactly the right person to find the link between meta-eloquence and brain chemistry.
"You've got the map, and I've got the key, love,"
he said while his hand snaked into the waistband of my skirt.
"How about we do a little practice unlocking?" I said. Lorenzo brought out my inner coquette.
"Later?"
"Later. Same place."
We had a small cottage, the Crab Shack, as we called it, over in Anne Arundel County by the Chesapeake Bay, far enough from the suburban Maryland bungalow I share with Patrick and the kids to be discreet. The lease was still in Lorenzo's name 2 months ago. Better not to go there right now. Besides, he'll have already given the place up. I pack my laptop and files, all but one, into the briefcase I've carried since my days in graduate school with Jackie, and head out the door, a pleasant smile on my face that I hope hides my trickery from Morgan. I want to buy as much time as I can this summer, stretch out the work long enough to get Sonia on track. In my car, driving from rural Maryland into the congestion of Washington, D.C., I think about how I found the physical locus and how Lorenzo's work on verbal and semantic fluency identified the protein. I knew it. Lynn and Lorenzo knew it. But Morgan doesn't need to know it. Not yet. 25. My office is something between a cave and a monk's cell, but less luxurious given the pair of desks and chairs crammed inside. Also, it lacks a window, unless you count the glass pane in the door that gives the workspace all the privacy of a fishbowl. A scarf and purse, both on the tattered side of wear, sit on one of the desks. I recognize both as Lynn's. Morgan shows me inside and leaves me to get settled. He says he'll come back in a few minutes to take me around the lab, get me set up with an ID tag, and show me where the copier room and the printer area are. I now know nothing I do here will be unseen by other eyes. Oddly, I don't care. The idea of seeing Lynn again, of talking to her and working with her, has me as high as a schoolgirl at her first dance.
"Oh my God," a wisp of a voice says from the doorway. Lynn Kwan is a small woman. I often told Patrick she could fit in one of my pants legs, and I'm only 5.5 feet and 120 soaking wet, thanks to the stress diet I've been on for the past several months. Everything about her is small. Her voice, her almond eyes, the sleek bob that barely reaches below her ears. Lynn's breasts and ass make me look like a Peter Paul Rubens model. But her brain? Her brain is a leviathan of gray matter. It would have to be. MIT doesn't hand out dual PhDs for nothing. Like me, Lynn is a neurolinguist. Unlike me, she's a medical doctor, a surgeon, to be specific. She left her practice fixing brains 15 years ago, when she was in her late 40s, and moved to Boston. 5 years later, she left with a doctorate in each hand, one in cognitive science, one in linguistics. If anyone can make me feel like the class dunce, it's Lynn. And I love her for it. She sets the bar as high as Everest. Lynn steps in and glances down at my left wrist.
"You too, huh?"
Then she bear hugs me, which is interesting since she's shorter and narrower than I am. It's a little like being bear hugged by a Barbie doll. "Me too," I say, laughing and crying at the same time. After what seems like an hour, she releases me from her clutch and steps back.
"You're exactly the same. Maybe even younger looking."
"Well, it's amazing what a year off of working for you has done," I say. The humor doesn't work. She shakes her head and raises a hand, thumb and forefinger a fraction of an inch apart.
"I was this close to going to Malaysia to visit my family. This close."
Her fingers fly apart into a starfish as she blows out air.
"Gone. Gone in a bloody day."
You sound like the queen, I say, except for that bloody part.
Don't kid yourself. Even QE2 knows how to curse. Speaking of which, did anyone tell you about the latest model of wrist monster?
When she says this, it comes out like monster, R-less and elegant.
They didn't just tell me about it.
I explained my 8-hour experience with the upgrade. If I'd had to read that manifesto shit once more, I would have cut out my own tongue. She perches on the desk, one bare leg swinging in the air, and lowers her voice after checking the door.
You know they'll put them back on, Jean, don't you? As soon as we finish.
We don't have to finish right away, I say, my back to the door. Even if we can, we don't have to. I pick up the silk scarf.
Tell me you haven't started wearing this on your head.
What do you think?
I think that's, in Lynn's terms, about as bloody likely as a pig with wings, and I tell her so, which gets a laugh. Then she's serious again.
We need to do something, Jean. Something besides working on the Wernicke project.
I know. How about we reverse the serum and spike the White House's water supply? I say this knowing it's even less likely than Lynn walking around with a headscarf and a pure pin on her collar.
Now there's an idea, she says.
I can't tell whether her voice carries a hint of sarcasm or approbation. She hops up and takes my arm.
Let's go get an espresso before Morgan the moron comes back.
They have an espresso machine here, I say, letting her lead me out of the office and down the gray corridor. All the workstations and offices we pass are empty.
No, but Lorenzo has his little coffee maker.
Oh boy.
26. Lorenzo's office is an exact copy of the one Lynn and I are sharing, except that it's twice as big, the desk is wood instead of metal, the chair looks as if it came off a Star Trek set, and there's a window that overlooks a park strewn with blooming cherry trees. I growl on the inside. Lynn pushes me through the doorway and escapes back down the hall before I can protest.
Ciao,
Lorenzo says. His voice is the same and different. Still low and musical, with the same softened consonants that bring me back to southern Italy, to a slower life. But there's a weariness in that single syllable that matches the lines in his face, deeper now after only 2 months. I can't help but stare into his dark eyes, and when I do, I see every word trapped inside him. All of a sudden, there's a lump in my throat the size of a beach ball. I try to say ciao around it, and what comes out has all the force of a mouse fart. My knees give way as the room spins around me, multiple Lorenzos and coffee makers and bookshelves all swirling in a whirlpool of color and texture. He catches me on the way down and props me in the large leather chair behind his desk, taking the smaller visitor's chair for himself.
Nice to know I still make you weak in the knees, Gianna.
In one reality, I recover completely from what women used to call la petite mort, stretch my neck to meet Lorenzo's face, and wrap both arms around him. We kiss, slowly at first, then furiously. Then all hell breaks loose, and I've got him on the desk, or he's got me on the desk, or we've got each other under the desk. It's fantastic and loud and wet and sweaty and perfect. Then there's the other reality, the one that's actually happening. The one where I have precisely enough time to drag the plastic-lined wastebasket from its corner, line it up under me, and lose my breakfast into it with a very unsexy slosh. All Lorenzo says is,
"Wow."
"I've gotta go," I say, pulling myself up, using the desk for leverage. "Ladies' room." I think the true test of a man is how he acts when a woman pukes in front of him. In his office, into his wastebasket. What Lorenzo did, right before he walked me to the door of the women's restroom at the opposite end of the hall from my office, was smile. A wow and a smile. Nothing more. I love him for that. "I'll be fine. Just need a minute," I say, pushing the door open and heading for the closest stall. The rest of my bagel and coffee comes up,
and I flush it away before sitting on the toilet seat with my head between my legs and the bitter bile and stomach acid in my throat. I never get sick, and I don't have a sensitive gut, and I can't remember the last time I puked. Yes, I can. The stainless steel box with its hinged lid and plastic liner is to my right, opposite the industrial toilet paper dispenser that could wipe the bottoms of a small country before it runs out. I don't have anything to put in it, no carefully wrapped tampon, no rolled and taped napkin, not even a mini pad. Oh, holy shit. I'm 43 years old. I have 4 kids, thanks to Patrick and his Irish virility. I had twins 11 years ago, and I know enough about reproductive biology to realize that my chances of having multiples are higher now than they were then. I also know I've got a 1 in 2 chance of having another girl. Will they snap a word counter on her wrist the second she pops out, or will they wait a few days? In any case, it will happen quickly, and I won't have any more bargaining chips. So I do what any woman in my position would do. I throw up all over again. 27. Lynn is waiting for me outside the restroom door, her face painted with concern.
You okay, honey? She says.
Fine, except half of my breakfast is in his office. She puts an arm around my waist and leads me back to our hobbit hole, cleans a smudge of mascara with a wet wipe from the bottomless pit of her purse, and gets right to the point.
You put a rather literal definition on lovesick, Jean, and don't pretend you have no idea what I'm talking about. Still got a thing for our Italian colleague?
I sink into the task chair behind my desk.
It's that obvious?
Now I'm wondering whether the entire department, including Morgan, was on to my regular meetings with Lorenzo in his office.
Who else knows?
Lynn leans in toward me, elbows on the desk between us.
If you're worried about Morgan, don't be. He's an idiot, he's self-absorbed, and he's a guy. He wouldn't recognize Afterglow if someone poured a bottle of it on his head. I doubt he noticed your wardrobe change either.
Her smile fades into a line, and the line becomes a frown.
But be careful. You don't want Carl Corbin's adultery wagon coming for you.
No, I say, and feel sick all over again. In our new, abnormal world, a surprising number of things are exactly as they used to be. We eat, we shop, we sleep, we send our kids to school, and we fuck. Only there are rules about fucking.
How long has it been going on?
Lynn asks.
About 2 years, I guess.
There's no sense in telling her I can point to the exact date when I first noticed Lorenzo's hand on the satin wood of the music box, when I felt a pleasant electrical current run up and down my spine at the thought of that hand on my skin.
Only before or after?
I float away from her now, from the sterile functionality of our office to the cluttered crab shack in Maryland, its walls covered from floor to ceiling with marine-themed kitsch. A fishing net there, a bottled boat on the windowsill, a rusted anchor leaning against a wall in the corner, and a bed. It's the bed I remember best, because it was lumpy and squeaky and too narrow for both of us to lie on comfortably without overlapping limbs. I loved that bed. We shared it only once after the Pure movement went national, which is what Lynn meant by only before or after. I'd taken the metro down to Eastern Market in early March to the cheese shop that used to be run by an elderly couple and now was the sole concern of the husband. I can't remember what I was looking for. Maybe smoked scamorza, maybe fresh ricotta, or maybe I wasn't looking for cheese at all. He stood there at the baker's stall with an armful of produce and flowers and with a distant look in his eyes. We'd spent 10 months without seeing each other, not once, and we would have gone on not seeing each other if I hadn't left the cheese shop and walked straight across the market hall. I risked 2 words.
Still here?
Still here. I have a ticket home in August, he said, after the summer term finishes. I can't stay in your country any longer.
As he spoke, he avoided my eyes and fixed on the silver bracelet.
I wouldn't have stayed out the summer, but they made me a generous offer.
August was 5 months away. When he left, I knew he would never come back to the States. Who would? Lorenzo paid for his bread.
Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back.
He disappeared through the crowded market to the far end where the cafe and the wine shop were. This was a Tuesday morning, unusually warm for March, which had a habit of hitting Washington with a fresh blast of winter, as if to remind us that the season wasn't over yet, not without one last bang. My head told me to run out the side door, forgetting the cheese, and hop the next train back home, or anywhere. My feet disobeyed and remained glued to the floor. And then he was back, another bag added to the collection of groceries he'd already purchased.
Meet me in the 8th Street alley in 10 minutes, was all he said.
Officially, premarital and extramarital sex were illegal. They'd always been illegal in most states, a holdover from the days of pre-Middle Ages sodomy laws that forbade even a married couple from engaging in anything other than vaginal intercourse. Immoral and unnatural were the benchmarks. Rarely was anyone charged and criminalized for fellatio or anal play, though, and affairs outside the marital bed were regarded as normal, if not commendable, acts. And birth control? That's a good one. The pharmacy shelf that used to hold Trojan and Durex and Lifestyles boxes is stocked with baby food and diapers. A logical replacement. Reverend Carl had a few things to say about sexual morality when he rose to his current seat of power. No elections were held, no confirmation hearings. The president wanted votes, and he got them. All Sam Myers needed to do was listen to an unofficial right-hand man, a man with the attentive ears of millions who thought moving 100 years in reverse was actually desirable. Blessed be the loophole. I don't know if there's really an adultery wagon, but I do know what happened to Annie Wilson down the street when her husband called in the infraction. It was on television, a handful of days after my world changed. Annie Wilson was a tart in housewife clothing. At least she dressed down when her husband was home. I expect she made a beeline for her wardrobe on Wednesday mornings after he left for work and reversed the dolling-up process in early afternoon after the man in the old blue pickup started his truck and left for another week. They had an arrangement. I shouldn't call her a tart. I'm no better, and Annie's husband was no Prince Charming. She'd been wanting to leave him for 2 years, and once he canceled her credit cards and stopped payments on her car, Annie might as well have been living in a maximum security prison. One Wednesday, I remember cheering her on, silently urging her to just walk out of the house and get in that blue pickup and never look back. If she hadn't had the 2 boys, both under 10, maybe she would have done that. And if she'd run off that Wednesday afternoon, maybe I wouldn't have had to watch her on television that night as Reverend Carl Corbin handed her over to 2 blandly dressed women with grave faces that matched their long habits. Maybe I wouldn't have had to hear him tell us about the convent in North Dakota where Annie Wilson would live out her life with a wrist counter set to a daily maximum of 0. What made up my mind to walk out of Eastern Market and head for Lorenzo's car in the alley across the street wasn't only lust, and it wasn't only the one-sided argument I'd had with Patrick that morning. Rage had been crackling inside me like a fire, first a slow burn, then an inferno. I knew all about the double standard, the private clubs that had cropped up in cities and towns where single men of certain means could go to unload their stress and sperm on professional ladies of the entertaining sort. Patrick had told me about the clubs after overhearing a conversation at work. They were the last places where you could get your hands on a box of rubbers. Prostitution, they say, is the oldest profession, and you can't kill anything that old. Also, the gays had been taken care of in their prison camps. The adulteresses, like Annie Wilson, were working farms in North Dakota or the grain belt of the Midwest. The pure had to do something about single women who had no families to take them in. They couldn't very well live on their own with no words and no income. They were given a choice, marry or move to a cat house. When I thought of Sonia, of what would happen to her if Patrick and I were out of the picture, of whether she would be forced into a loveless marriage or sent away to a commune of whores where she could do nothing with her mouth but suck and moan, my blood boiled. Even the whores were supposed to shut up and behave. So I walked out of Eastern Market and across the street, dodging potholes and semi-frozen puddles, and got into Lorenzo's car. It was the only method I had of saying fuck you to the system. Thanks to raging hormones and my own idiocy, the system said fuck you right back. Lorenzo and I went at it 3 times, one with a condom. The others, bareback all the way. Christ, it was good. Lynn takes my hand, bringing me from that afternoon to this morning.
Be careful, honey. You've got a lot more to lose than your voice.
I know, I say, and pull myself together just as Morgan knocks at our door. 28. Morgan leads us along the hall, collects Lorenzo from his office, and pauses with his nose wrinkled.
What's that smell? He says.
I don't smell anything,
Lorenzo says flatly, but his eyes are smiling at me. Lynn plays along.
Neither do I.
Well, let's get to it, people. Lots of ground to cover if we're going to meet our deadline.
This is the first I've heard about a deadline, and any respect I might have had for Morgan drops down another several notches. He can't possibly know we've already found the Wernicke cure, and I wonder what he's promised the president. It's not as if we're baking a goddamned cake. What deadline? I say. Morgan hesitates, as if he's inventing a story to tell us. When he finally speaks, it sounds like a well-rehearsed line.
The president is due to travel to France at the end of June for the G20 summit. He needs his brother.
This is May, I tell him. I thought we had more time. The contract didn't say anything, but he cuts me off.
You didn't really read your contract, Dr. McClellan. If you had, you would have seen a clear deadline of June 24th, 1 week before the president flies to Europe. Any more questions?
We're scientists, I say. We don't do deadlines. Lorenzo, who has been quiet up until now, shuts his office door.
I'll explain it to them later, Morgan. Let's get on with the admin shit so we can start working on your problem.
I flash him a look of disbelief, as does Lynn, but Lorenzo shakes his head. Later, he mouths. Our first stop is the security office, a series of rooms and cubicles staffed by 20 men. It isn't in our section of the building, which is unpopulated except for Lorenzo, Lynn, and myself, but one floor down. There are no windows here, not even on the main door, which Morgan unlocked by inserting a card from the lanyard around his neck into the reader.
We're all about security, he says, leading us through the sea of computers and surveillance equipment toward one of the smaller cubicles.
Lynn and I exchange a look.
Security for what? I ask.
Morgan doesn't answer, but I know he's heard me. I repeat the question.
Just general security, Dr. McClellan. Not something you need to worry about.
He turns to the man in the cubicle.
We'll need card keys from my team, Jack.
Again with the my. Jack grunts but doesn't smile. I put him at about 50, maybe pushing 60. His suit jacket hangs on the chair behind him, wrinkled and well-worn. The white shirt stretches taut against an ample beer belly, and yellowish patches bloom under his arms. His collar is pierced with a silver pin, a blue P in a circle. I wonder if he's married, if some poor woman has to lie underneath him while he grunts and sweats. Or, if he's single, is he high enough up in the hierarchy to merit right of access to one of the city's private men's clubs? For the second time today, I picture Sonia, 20 years old, playing courtesan, satisfying a monster's appetite.
Sit here,
Jack says, nodding to me and indicating the chair next to his desk.
Right hand here, palm down.
He points to a flat screen on the desk, polished to a high shine. I place my hand on the surface. It's cold, but not as cold as Jack. The machine whirs, and a band of light scans my handprint.
Look straight ahead. Don't smile, he orders.
The camera in front of me snaps a picture.
You're done. Now you,
Jack nods to Lynn, and she goes through the same procedure. When Jack grunts another order, she stands up.
You're in the dark as much as I am, aren't you, Jean?
Lynn says.
Shut up, Jack tells her.
He turns to Lorenzo.
Dr. Rossi, please take a seat. Right hand on the screen.
Asshole, I think. There are no pictures on Jack's desk. No family portraits, no school photos of kids against a cloud or forest background, no decorations. His lunch, or what I think is his lunch, is in a crumpled paper bag that looks like it might not stand up to another emptying and refilling. I'm thinking Jack isn't married, and I find the thought appealing. Better to suffer through a few minutes of prodding and poking and heavy breathing once a week than to live with him 24/7. Lorenzo's finished, and the printer behind Jack spits out three plastic ID cards. Jack holds out a hand toward Morgan, and they shake. When he holds the same hand out to Lorenzo, nothing happens.
I don't think so,
Lorenzo says.
Something might rub off on me.
This is why I love Lorenzo, or one of about 100 reasons. Patrick would have shaken hands with the fat creep. Patrick would have smiled and said, thanks, when Jack handed him the laminated keycard. Patrick would be seething on the inside, but he'd play the game. We leave Jack's cubicle, and Morgan ushers us into a small conference room in the security complex. It's set up not in conference style, but with the table pushed off to one side, two chairs behind it, and three chairs lined up like school desks facing the table. Morgan takes a seat at the head of the class and holds out a hand, motioning for the three of us to sit in the chairs facing him. I exchange a look with Lorenzo, but he shakes his head, almost imperceptibly. And we wait. After 10 minutes of listening to the wall clock tick, a sullen man with a scar on his right cheek and with all the charm of a special forces veteran enters through the open door to the conference room.
Morning, Morgan,
he says.
Morning, team,
he says to the rest of us. He doesn't sit, but stands behind the table, looking down at his audience. A man of his size should have made at least some noise in the hallway, but this one crept up on us. It takes me exactly 5 seconds to realize I don't like him. By the sour look on Lynn's face, she spent even less time contemplating his likability.
I'll keep this short and to the point, because you all have work to do,
he says.
I'm Mr. Poe, and I'm in charge of Project Security.
His lips barely move as he speaks. His heavy chest doesn't seem to rise and fall. I don't think he's blinked once since he entered the room.
You have one job to do here. The operative words are one and here. That means you do your work, you leave, and you come back the next day. I don't want any discussion of the work with the rest of the lab or any socializing among you outside office hours. Clear? As crystal,
Lorenzo says, examining one of his own fingernails. Poe glares at him.
You don't talk about the project with anyone outside these walls. You don't bring work home. If you need to work more than 8 hours a day, you do it here. Lunch is in the cafeteria on the third floor.
He checks a printed schedule.
You three have the 1 p.m. slot to yourselves.
Lynn shifts in her chair, uncrosses her legs, then crosses them again. Her foot brushes mine, and I push back on it. Yes, that sounds weird. I speak first. Excuse me, Mr. Poe, but what about the lab assistants? We need to set up experiments, and we... Poe cuts me off.
Any instructions to the lab staff go through Morgan. Also, you won't be taking your laptops home. One of my men will set up appointments with you for this afternoon to secure your electronics and set up the intranet for your part of the team. I thought we were the team,
Lorenzo says, a bit dryly.
That's what Mr. Poe means,
Morgan says. His eyes dart toward the big man standing next to him.
Right, Mr. Poe? Exactly. Any other questions?
He doesn't wait.
You'll each go through a security checkpoint when you enter the building and when you leave. The building is staffed around the clock.
Poe nods once to Morgan before turning his back on us and leaving the way he came in, quietly.
Okay.
Morgan claps his hands together once, as if he's calling an unruly class to order.
Let's get to work. If you follow me, I'll show you around the lab.
We file out of the conference room, past Fat Jack, who is slurping down a Coke, and back through the windowless main door. Morgan opens this with his keycard, which, unlike mine and Lorenzo's and Lynn's, is blue. Ours are white. Lynn pulls me back as we walk down the hall toward the elevator bank.
That Poe, silent but deadly type, she says.
Very, I say.
What's with the segregation and the deadline? Don't know, but if we're on our own at lunch, we'll have a chance to talk. Lorenzo seems like he knows something.
Come on, ladies, Morgan calls from the elevator he's holding open.
We pick up the pace and arrive at the open doors. Morgan walks in first, Lorenzo last. When we're inside, he reaches behind and squeezes my hand.
Very exciting day, Morgan says.
Yes, it is. 29. The first thing I hear as we walk the 10 feet from the elevator to the lab complex is the squeak of mice. The animals are a necessity, but I still get squeamish about injecting the tiny beasts with untested sera. They're so helpless, like babies. I can't stand holding them and looking into their oil drop eyes and squeezing whatever my latest potion is into their innocent veins. Lynn has no problem with it. Maybe her medical background makes her immune. I've always let her administer the injections.
They're mice, Jean, she would say back in our Georgetown lab. You'd set traps for them if they invaded your pantry, wouldn't you?
Well, she had me there. But the traps were passive devices. I could deal with them better than I could deal with needles full of chemicals. I've always been a textbook kind of girl when it comes to anything brain-related. Let the MDs fiddle with the practical stuff. Morgan is poised with his keycard at the door, then reconsiders.
Might as well try one of yours to make sure it works. Dr. McClellan, how about you do the honors?
Lorenzo chuckles.
Come on, Jana. You won't know what's inside until you open it.
I slide my white keycard into the reader, wondering if Lorenzo realizes how like Pandora I feel as the doors swing open and we're momentarily blinded by the fluorescent lights that come alive inside the lab. There can't be any evil here, I think, only the hope that also hid inside Pandora's ancient box. Still, something about Poe's slip of the tongue about our part of the team, if it was a slip of the tongue, makes me uneasy. For that matter, Poe himself makes me uneasy. He's built like a refrigerator and silent as a grave, and he has the look of a man who's killed for God or country. Or money. Morgan beams as if the lab were his own firstborn son and motions us to follow him inside. Once again, Lorenzo waits for Lynn and me to enter before walking through the double doors. The squeaks of a few hundred mice fly out of the cages lining the left wall. On the right, there are rabbits, sniffing silently, their pink noses twitching at the intrusion into their space. We've never had rabbits before, and I know Lynn will have to take care of the injections when we get around to the larger animals. No way I could plug an Easter bunny with anything unless I was damned sure. But I am sure, and that's the hell of it. If I want to draw out the project as long as possible, I'll need to kill a few mice and bunnies. Lab tables, 10 of them, each with its own workstation, fill the empty area between the rows of cages. Like the offices and cubicles in our department of three, they're unoccupied. At the end of the room is another door, also with a keycard reader. This time it's Lynn's turn, and once again Morgan walks past us into the belly of the lab.
Holy shit,
Lynn says. Morgan twitches at this. Good. Lorenzo utters a single Italian word, as ubiquitous and productive as English's fuck.
Cazzo.
They're both right. This space is like nothing I've ever seen. On my right are three doors, marked with the sign, Patient Prep Room, Please Knock Before Entering. Beyond these is an open area with a bank of computers and cabinetry to hold smaller equipment. Portable ultrasound, TMS, and TDCS are printed on neat labels below each cabinet.
Nice,
Lorenzo says.
Transcranial magnetic stimulation and direct current stimulation. How many units?
5 of each, Morgan says, opening the cabinets one at a time. And 3 portable ultrasound kits, all with various transducers. He reads the labels. Linear, sector, convex, neonatal, transvaginal. There's a pause before the last item, as if he's put off by the mention of female anatomy, even though Morgan should know we need the transvaginal probes for our smaller subjects. I've said before, he's a shitty scientist. Lorenzo winks at me. There's more over here, Morgan says, and leads our tiny parade past the open area and toward the back of the lab. Here, 2 doors lead to the MRI rooms.
You've got 2 magnetic resonance imaging setups? I ask, nudging Lynn, who is almost drooling.
Back at Georgetown, we had to beg for the use of 1 MRI in the hospital, a 20-minute walk away. And that was when we were allowed the time, which wasn't often. Morgan beams.
2 Tesla MRIs, and here's the PET facility.
He opens another door and lets us peek inside. We had to wait months for access to the hospital's positron emission tomography, or PET equipment.
What about EEGs? Lorenzo asks. And the biochem lab?
All here. The electrocephalography stuff is over in the small equipment area.
Electroencephalography, I correct. That's why they call it EEG and not ECG. Morgan's eyes scrunch together.
Whatever. Anyway, I forgot to mention it, but you'll find the electrodes and the printer in the far right cabinet. The biochem lab is through these doors.
He motions to Lorenzo's keycard.
Go ahead. You'll probably be most interested in the protein expression module. It's just here, to your right.
Morgan points, but Lorenzo is still scanning the room, which could hold 5 high school chem labs. There are only 3 of us. 4 if we count Morgan, but I don't think any of us is counting him. And only 1 biochemist.
Okay, people. Morgan checks his watch. Got a meeting with the big guys, so I'll leave you to it.
You do that, Lorenzo says, and slides his keycard into the biochem lab door.
We'll be fine.
Internet, I say, pointing to a bank of computers with monitors the size of flat-screen televisions in the main lab.
No way, Jean.
Morgan fires up one of the workstations.
Excel, Word, SPSS in case you need to run statistics, MATLAB, whatever you need.
All I need if I want to work in a vacuum, I think.
How about access to the world of periodicals, Morgan? I don't carry the past 5 years of the Journal of Cognitive Neuroscience around in my purse.
Oh, that, right.
He moves toward a rack filled with tablets.
All plugged into the academic databases. If you can't find what you want, call up on the intercom. I'll make it happen.
Morgan smiles, showing 2 neat rows of small teeth. They remind me of a hamster. Or a lab rat.
Got a buzz now, people,
he says, and disappears through the rodent room and out the main doors. Finally, we're alone.
15 million for the 2 Tesla MRIs and the PET machine,
Lynn says when we hear the double click of the main doors to the lab.
15 million, and then there's everything else.
We all know the numbers. The National Science Foundation did all but stick a laughing emoticon on our last grant proposal when we asked for a single MRI setup. I run some rough calculations in my head and come up with a figure. Lorenzo nods.
25 million sounds about right. But that's not what bothers me.
Me neither, I say.
We lock eyes, the 3 of us, alternately, and I know we're thinking the same thing. Every piece of equipment is new, shiny, recently installed, and all of it is exactly what we need to work on the Wernicke cure. You don't set up a lab with $25 million worth of apparatus in 3 days. Also, there was that animal smell in the first room. The mice and rabbits have been here a while. They've been here longer than the president's brother has been in intensive care.
It's almost as if they already knew, Lynn says. As if they'd planned for it.
I look around, moving from the biochem lab, past the MRI and PET scan rooms, toward the open area housing small equipment. In our world, small doesn't mean cheap. We need to talk, I say, addressing them both, but I know I'm looking